and unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good evening. Does anyone need a copy of these? Do you have one at home? Or?
Yes.
We couldn't
find them.
Oh, do you need one too?
We'll give them back at
if you find them, okay.
We will find them too, sorry.
Why don't you, if you have one at home, maybe give them back at the end here. Right. Try to remember to bring these. So there's maybe Sally, the only one, maybe wasn't here last time. Anyone just arriving? So just a brief review. We started talking about these different types of self, right? Different versions of actually what we call me, of the self. And particularly the inherently existent self, which doesn't exist at all. There's other selves that do conventionally exist, so we don't just disappear. But this inherently existent self is defined here as the innate, deeply rooted illusion that the conceptually imputed self, which is the previous one, exists by way of its own character, from its own side. This self, which appears to be completely mixed with the five aggregates, is the most subtle self that must be refuted. So now we had this, the homework assignment was to try to identify the sense of this self. Part of the tricky thing here is that the conceptually imputed self, to review there again, is this conventionally existent self, and it's an aspect of dependent co-arising. It's imagined to be inherently existent, which is the one we just talked about, but it's actually merely imputed or imagined or ascribed in dependence on the five aggregates, the five skandhas, body and mind. And it's also called the mere I. It's just the mere I in quotes, you know, just, it's what we refer to as self. And this self is what I actually refers to. Like the Buddha can say I, he refers to this, it's just this mere conceptual idea that depends on, we don't just randomly make it up, we impute or come up with this idea dependent on the body and mind, dependent on the five aggregates of body and mind. And it's fine to have that mere I. And then that one is then kind of reified, it's made solid, it's made substantial, and it's imagined to be inherently existent. So when we're looking for in our experience this inherently existent I, it's, for one thing, it appears to be mixed with body and mind, completely mixed together with body and mind, and it also appears to be mixed together with this, just mere, the mere I, the mere conceptual imputation. That might be a kind of tricky thing there. Can you get a sense of what that, how that mix works? That the sense of self, in a way, has these three different aspects mixed together. There's the body-mind experience of the present, just arising and ceasing, that we generally, this area of body and mind experience is where we start relating to the sense of a self, me. And so this body-mind experience is mixed together with both the mere I, because the mere I, remember, is an imputation, an idea dependent on the body and mind. So although it's not quite the same, it's not really mixed exactly, it's dependent on, but in our experience it seems to be, the idea of me seems to be completely mixed together with our body-mind experience of the present moment. And this mere I appears to be completely mixed together with this imagination, with this view, with this belief that there's a substantial, a permanent, singular, and independent self. Can you follow that a little bit? The whole thing is pretty, this mixed up thing, it's pretty mixed up. It's our experience is like, to tease these things apart, these types of self, is quite difficult. I mean, they're all kind of mixed together.
What's the third one? Could you talk about that third one again?
Well,
after the mere I, that
the inherently existent I. So the mere I is it's just merely a conceptual thing that the mind does automatically for all of us. And we, in order to think about ourself, the mind comes up with this conceptual version of me. It's just a thought, and it's very convenient. It's very useful. Without that, how would we talk about the difference between me and you? So it's a language thing that is very useful, but it's just an idea. In order to talk about this collection of body-mind experience, we have this word me, or like Kokyo, or whatever we refer to, I, me, the self. But the thing is, it's imagined to be inherently existent. It means it's imagined to exist in and of itself, not just a conceptual idea. It's imagined to really be a real self. And as we talked about last week, I think this is important because we hear these teachings about no self from early on in Buddhist teachings, and we hear, well, there's just the changing body-mind experience. There's no permanent, singular, independent self, and we maybe pretty quickly can come to see that, like, yeah, that makes sense, and we kind of agree with that, and that's my view now. Yeah, there's no independent self, but our experience, and this was why this homework I thought would be interesting, to try to locate in our experience this sense. I like to call it a sense, but it's actually a misconception or sense that there's actually somebody here more than just the ever-changing body-mind experience. Yes.
I tried to practice with this, and at first it was kind of interesting to locate, okay, yeah, I do think I'm being insulted or something is coming at me. But I found that my mind wasn't interested in being all that subtle. And so it was, the response was kind of like, to recognize, okay, so this is suffering, that's this, you said, look for that, okay, this is suffering, maybe all suffering has this component, and then it was hard to keep with the investigation. It was kind of, okay, suffering, and then not wanting to look much further,
The investigation of whether it really exists or not.
I think at the beginning of the week, I was, in particular thing I was struggling with, was able to have more sense of like, okay, count lots coming together to make this.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it seemed like it's associated with individual karmic streams of other people and myself. Really hard to let go of, the kind of wrong thinking of, or I don't know if it's wrong thinking of, like, there is a karmic stream associated with what I call Liz that I really don't want or like, but I'm in the middle of.
Yeah, in a way, that's starting to analyze and get into how it actually arises depending on others and all. And that's part of the investigation, but I think it's a really valuable thing, and this is how, and this kind of meditation is traditionally presented before you actually, the nice thing with this part, to make it easier, is before doing any analysis, before, in fact, it's quite important to see, before just kind of like doing our, you know, seeing that, oh, it's just an illusion, it's saying, don't do that yet. It's saying, get a good, strong look at it, get a good, strong focus, and on what appears to be inherently existing. And this is what I mentioned in some traditions. They say before you actually do any of the reasoning and analysis to show how it's not going to hold up, you just spend weeks actually just getting into this view that, like, I really exist. But you're not so much creating it. The idea is that, like, the proposal anyway, is that we have it already. So it's just like locating this sense of this self that's, it's actually a misconception, but don't just say it, if we say it's a misconception, see, this is the problem with having heard these teachings, is it's so easy for the mind to just start, oh yeah, but I know, like, as soon as, especially if I'm strongly focusing on it, oh, I know it's not really real, it comes to be through these other people creating this together, but in a way, try not to do that at this first step of just really get into how it feels to sense that there's seems to be really a me. And then, so all those examples, the classic ways to bring it up if it's hard to locate it is imagine being falsely accused or, you know, getting really accused. But also any kinds of, I mean, in a way, it's always available, but in order, it's harder to find it. So in order to get a real sense of it, imagine kind of difficult situations where we're kind of like our buttons are pressed, right? Those are like, that's where the view of the independent self goes, and it's like, and then I think it's, in a way, it's a two-part thing. It's like feeling the sense and then just looking to see, without investigating, but just looking to see if it seems as if that me exists like in and of itself. Even though all our reasoning, we know it's not really going to hold up, but does it feel as if that me, you know, exists from its own side? Like, it's more than just a mere conception. And in my experience, it seems to be like it's something more than just a mere conception. There's sometimes it's a different place in the body. We can, or a different place in the emotions or whatever. So that's a good example. Looking for any other experiences, looking for this?
I had experience similar to this. And I went back and looked at other times when I've been really exercised at something. And I do see a difference from before I practiced and studied and since. And there's a quality of being stuck in a situation which is difficult to move. I witnessed a time when you were in a situation like that, and I had been in a similar situation, and there was no genteel way of getting around it. And so my question is, our bodies have alarm systems, and certain glands will squirt at certain thresholds, and, you know, it's fight or flight. And now, we're not confusing that, that kind of heightened sense, with three, are we?
Well, I wouldn't say exactly, but that's a great question, because I think it's very close. I think at that time when we feel those glands squirting, to actually, like, if we can catch it, and this might be really hard because we're in a mode of fight or flight, so it might be hard to notice this, but without any analysis or anything, just to ask the question, like, at that time when we're charged up, right, does it, just the simple question of, does it seem like this, like me right now, exists in and of itself? Is there something more than the body-mind experience? Because there definitely is a body and mind experience.
Yeah.
But is there something more?
Yeah. So before, I would definitely initiate a narrative that kind of started with the premise, don't you know who I am? That sort of thing. And I would often carry that into the car driving away and have a legal argument with the person who's not even there. That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started adding a narrative to it, then I definitely had a sense of self. But now I just say, wow, I'm going to have to metabolize all this adrenaline now. And I don't have so much that narrative. And I kind of associated that with what you said. I don't know if I'm correct in that. But
I had way too much narrative.
I don't. Really? When you said, I'm not that interested in going into it, I have that sense. Once I identify that, whoa, I got to probably about, let's see, 20 minutes of having to metabolize this crap, I just, okay, and I let it metabolize. Instead of going on, I wasn't interested in saying, well, you know, let me analyze this some more, because frankly, it was pissing me off. So, no, I get it. I get it. And I don't want to have an identity with that. But I do think there is kind of a physical metabolism that takes place, and it's going to take so much time no matter what.
But, I mean, do you look at the time that's happening? Can you see, does it seem to be, regardless, and this is the part I think we have to put aside because we've heard all these teachings, regardless of what we've heard, and kind of amazingly, despite everything we've heard about no self, at the time, this particularly the moment, not the later kind of flowing of the chemicals, but when it first starts happening, especially, and maybe later too, Does it seem as if, not so much the physical, emotional feeling, but what that's based on? Does it seem like at the center of that, there's this sense that there's a me that just got attacked?
I have a sense that I have the option of taking it that way if I want to.
But I guess the question is, is it even possible to not take it that way at the first moment of attack? It's so quick, right?
Well, there's a definite sense that a threshold has been crossed, and it's in this nexus of experience. Mm-hmm. Now, whether I choose to take that as a personal insult or just kind of a generalized insult on my experience, I honestly can't say yes for that.
Well, I guess I would propose, and this may not be right, my understanding now is that if there's this big charge, body-mind charge, that gets the chemicals flowing, I think, this is my own experience, that view is actually, even if there's other times when it's completely seen through, that view is from past habit, from eons of past habit, is actually activated. I think it's not just like, well, the view's not there, because then where does the response come from? The kind of defensive quality.
Where does it come from?
Yeah, where could it come? Where could defensive reaction come from if not... there's a me here in relation to an other that's...
Well, I think it's an endocrine and neurological thing, honestly.
I guess I'm saying that the neurological reaction is based on this misconception. And I'd say that because if we just go to the tradition, it looks like the Buddha, there were times when the Buddha was like incredibly attacked, like emotionally and physically, and some people were really trying to get him even sometimes. And he would just, you know, smile. He didn't have, those chemicals didn't flow. So I think there is a possibility of like seeing through this misconception so deeply that the neurological thing actually no longer happens.
Really?
This is why hopefully this is a really radical proposal.
I know I have a default, and maybe that default is still there, and I have to say no. I mean, I will stipulate there is a default position, you know, to defend or to attack. For example, now it's gotten subtle enough where I refer to the precepts as my criterion, not how I feel. I'm aware of it soon enough, so that, I mean, it's almost sociopathic in a way, in that I don't have a lot of emotional response that drives me as much as saying it would be inappropriate for me to strike here, and can I invoke a compassionate response instead? That is, I would say, almost as strong now as a choice as the default position on being attacked. Maybe this default position is what we're talking about.
Something like that.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. That it's possible. And you know, even if we're not going to completely arrive at this point during this class or something,
yeah.
I'd like to propose that it's the infinite possibilities in this practice, and it might not be in our experience. We might say, well, that's so outside anything I can imagine, I don't even believe it's possible. But I think that's what the tradition is saying, is that we could, and it's not a sudden thing that happens overnight. It's a very gradual reapplying these teachings to this misconception. In fact, the tradition even has, which maybe we don't want to get into fully today, but just to bring up because it's kind of related to this, they talk about coarse and subtle selflessness, coarse and subtle identitylessness. And the coarse one is like, if you... This, the way the Dalai Lama talks about it is like, if you do this, all these reasonings that we haven't actually done yet, but if you get to that point where it's like, yeah, especially with a strong emotion, you feel like, yeah, I actually can see how it doesn't hold up. It's an illusion that this is based on. And then you apply it to your, to a part of the body-mind experience, like your arm. It says you like look at your arm or even your body, and if the first impulse of like shifting your, in a way, your investigation from the self to part to a body part, and if it seems that the arm like kind of exists in and of itself, that there's actually like an arm there at the first impulse, he said that's normal, but that if that's the case, that's then it probably means that you've understood a kind of coarse level of identitylessness of the self, and the kind of test to see if the subtle identitylessness has been fully understood is you look at a body part or a body, and immediately it's the same way. It's also just like a conception, or it doesn't exist in and of itself. And I think mostly we that happens for us. And also, another thing about the subtleness is like, it's good to start with these things of being falsely accused and like strong emotions to identify the self. But the more and more subtle, he says, there's no end to this process. For years and years, you can keep doing this meditation with more and more subtle levels of, even when you're just very comfortable and relaxed, like in Zazen, you could just, in Zazen, I'm not triggered or anything. My sense of self is like barely operating. That's why it's so nice, Zazen, right? But even then, you could, a really subtle form might be like, but does it still seem like there's somebody here, like meditating? Is there like a meditator? So, and I think even more subtle than that. So I think this is just a chance to, because actually everybody here has like quite a bit of practice background, so we've heard these teachings, and we say, instead of just saying, oh, these are all confirming my experience and like that's it, to see like is there a deeper sense of that experientially, particularly experientially, of this no abiding self.
So for quite a while, I resisted, you know, taking new office. I resisted that because I had this notion I did not want to affirm me. Mm-hmm. And then it dawned on me that refusing to take the rock of sleep was in fact doing that.
That's it, yeah.
Okay.
Almost anything we do can be.
Now, is that what we're talking about? That there was an I that was somehow didn't want to be associated with I-ness?
That could be an example, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then to try to locate that sense of I-ness and see, we mostly locate the reactions to it, like the false accusation when the chemicals start flowing. This first exercise would be like, you know, note this, be mindful of the experience, but then do this step of like, now just look without analyzing anything. Just look and see if it seems to be in our experience, you know, ideally apart from anything we've ever heard about the Dharma or anything, is our experience seem as if there's somebody here? And like, I think in even those examples you could probably find. Did you have a...
It went. It was this, I don't know if I can express it, but a sense that ultimately, I keep wanting to get to the ultimate thing. Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting that we really stay with this piece of what most of us think of trying to have tried to negate.
Exactly. And we know we're going to, if you read ahead, you see how we're going to negate it. But like, I think the thing is here, not jumping ahead, not trying to negate it. And the thing is, we can, it's a nice exercise to kind of jump ahead and negate it, and it's somewhat satisfying to do that. But I think part of the idea too of like, not jumping ahead is kind of like letting this thing build up so it's really clear, and then negating it. And then the impact of the contrast of this really strong feeling of this solid me and the absence of it at the same time is that has a much bigger impact than just like, oh yeah, okay, there's like the much bigger impact than the kind of theoretical thing of like, okay, there's like a self, but like it can't exist in this way, so there's not a self. Okay, cool. It's like, it actually doesn't really change our life that much. But if we're like, really get in touch with the problem, the thing that to be negated, the view actually, and it feels like it's not really, it doesn't feel like a view, but it's actually called a view or a misconception. If we can, you know, sense that more and more, watch how that works more and more. You could say this is studying the self, studying the false self, right? And by clarifying that more and more, then we can start to undo it. Yes.
I'm kind of curious about what you were talking about, that you have the chemical, you know, the flight fight response before you. My experience has been for a while since I've been noticing that kind of thing, is that I have the flight, and then I start deciding why afterwards. And it seems really like I keep thinking about Pavlov. Mm-hmm. Totally, like, it's happening before I think about it. And I can see the story that I start telling after. Mm. After I have the experience, and then I can get to keep the journal going even more.
Mm-hmm.
Now that makes sense to me, that's I, but the part where it just happens automatically,
That's what we're actually looking at. I think that's a good way
to bring it.
Yeah, we're looking at the immediate first before. Yeah, and we say, it's easy. I think maybe Western science or something might say, oh, that's not based on a misconception or a view. That's just like how sentient beings are wired to start pumping these chemicals when they're attacked. And but my current understanding today is that actually that moment is what we're looking for before conceptual stories, because this view is like, before it's so deep that it's like it's not about ideas and stuff. It's like it's a basic like misconception of like the reality, but in terms of like who we are, basic misconception of who we are. And we can't actually locate the view like in terms of a conceptual view. Like, that's why the word view is a little bit funny. Because it's like, we're trying to find this view, and we're like, okay, the view is that I inherently exist. Well, we don't think that way, actually. This view is like pre-verbal. It's like, but it's a misconception. And it is a mind thing. I mean, this is according to this tradition. It would be like, it's a mind-created misconstruing of this body-mind thing. Because like, you know, a machine or something wouldn't have that response. It comes with a sentient being to think of it. Not, I mean, think is not even quite right, but to understand itself as being an entity.
Well, actually, the machines do. I mean, on the submarine, we had a set point, and if it reached that, an alarm would go off. But in times of real critical emergency, we had to outrun a torpedo. We did what's called a battle short, and we took that alarm out of the system, and we ran the thing with danger of blowing up. But it had an internal conscience in that sense. It was a sense that says, you're at a threshold point where it could be very dangerous. And it was kind of set there, and that's kind of where I'm coming from. All these squirts go off, and then I have a choice at that point now of saying, okay, I'm going to be with this completely.
Yeah, we're talking about the kind of before that choice, the moment of the squirts. And this would be, you know, this might be off, but
I
like
to put down all of my science stuff.
Yeah. I think we can, let's put down science. Let's just check it out. Yeah, well, they do this, right? They have the chemical thing, but the proposal is, interestingly, that all sentient beings, animals, have this misconception. They hold a view. Now, this might get weird if we think of a mouse or some really primitive animal holds a view. But that's my understanding, and I think that's what the tradition is saying. Now, an ant, I don't know. but it does definitely look like mammals, for sure. And rodents, too, I think, seem to, again, it's not, this shows how deep this is. It's not a thinking thing that they learn. Again, they say we're born, it's innate, we're born with this, understanding, belief. You know, the animals have beliefs. Well, in a way, it's kind of a belief that that there's a sense that there's somebody, that there's me, in addition to just the body mind experience. And that you can see how evolution, if we want to go to science, you could see how you could say, well, evolution created this fight and flight response for the survival of the species. But I guess my way that I would tie it into science would be like, well, the way that evolution created this was to create this view. You know, if organisms start to see themselves as a self, then they can protect themselves. And maybe at first, again, there's this thing of being mixed together where there's the mere eye. I guess maybe I mentioned this last week. One evolutionary story I could imagine is at first there was just this mere eye. There were, you know, small, you know, simple organisms, and then it eventually developed what we call five skandhas, which was pretty early on in evolution. Animals have all these five aggregates. And at that time, then they, or maybe even before there were five, right, they could still starting to. They need maybe the third one, though, particularly. They need conception, the ability to conceive ideas, which not just humans, animals have this. And with this conception, then they can start to conceive of themselves as an entity. And then maybe at first, for maybe many millions of years or something, it was like there's just this mere eye, but then eventually that it started getting, you know, reified or solidified. And it's like, well, it's not just a mirror eye, there really is me here. And we might, again, we might say, well, do we even really, do we even have this view that there's really me here? So that's why I think this first investigation is, does it really seem in our experience, putting aside all our preconceptions and past Dharma teachings, does it actually seem, particularly at times when we're pushed, does it seem as if there's somebody here that exists? You know, these are terms we're not so used to. Is this inherently, exists independently? That's a little off, because we might say, well, obviously we depend on other things, so, but exists something that exists in and of itself, like, and another just common one that is like first thing we wake up in the morning and we feel like it's me, right? We feel like it's the same one who went to sleep the night before. This is now in the sense of time, permanence. We don't have to be triggered at all, but and maybe for like a moment or two, we forget who we are. And sometimes it's like that, we wake up and it's like, huh? Whoa, what's happening here? And then we're like pretty quickly, boom, yeah, like, oh, I'm here, and this is where I am, and this is my room, and like, this is what I'm doing today. And then we start, you know, constructing our day and our world and our identity. But sometimes we're able to catch when we like, kind of like, you know, grab onto that sense of identity. And any time that we don't do that, I shouldn't say any time, but sometimes we don't, it's quite uncomfortable. Like, I think that would be an example. Wake up and like, what is this? It's like being born again for maybe a split second. It might be quite uncomfortable, and like, we're quickly searching for an identity of who we are in our groggy mind, and it's pretty easy to do.
It happened to me once when I was traveling and I was super tired, and I woke up and I couldn't remember who I was. Yeah. And I just kept saying to myself, I'm on my way somewhere. But I didn't have a sense of gender or name or
cool.
Where I was.
Yeah.
It took about 90 seconds, I think.
Wow.
Coming in. I was so tired. I was just like, I did think of myself as a separate person. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, I'm on my way somewhere. And I was just exhausted. I was traveling. I had gotten a room after like 7 hours of trying to figure out what train station to be at. And when I woke up from this nap, I was just,
I had
an
identical experience.
We think that sometimes it's uncomfortable, but also sometimes it's if we're not trying to stop it, it's wonderful. We like lose our sense of self. Like the example that sometimes brought up is like playing music when you're totally engaged in it, and maybe any activity, you're just immersed, and we're not like, in a way, we have no identity for a little bit. Very nice. But then certain things usually then trigger us back into like grabbing an identity again. We can't sustain it for very long. It seems to be the case.
Well, on a couple of occasions that I said, oh, there's that self, this is what we're looking for for the class project. It changes a little bit, and one case in particular, I was aware of you know, just the noticing of it kind of reduces the fire a little bit, but it's so close to kindling that, you know, it flares back up again. Mm-hmm. But I think the point I was going to make here was that these episodes that I identified were very familiar. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, you know, inherent, you know, I don't know how far it went back, but it certainly was familiar. It certainly
like a habit.
A pattern. You know, the same things triggered me, or I used the same defenses or the same excuses.
Like, that's me. So that's how I do it. Yeah, we have those. That's maybe a good way to look for it, too, is like, familiar responses and like, And it's quite comfortable in a kind of uncomfortable way to have that very familiar sense of me. It's comfortable in the sense it's familiar, and it's the source of all these difficulties.
So, thank you, Patrick. Could we substitute or at least consider using as well, instead of innate, say intimately familiar as a...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That resolves my difficulty.
Innate. We don't need to, you know, even if tradition says we're born with it, it doesn't matter that much, I think. I just think it's if that's true, that it's innate, it just adds this layer of, like, that's how deep this sits. It's not like something that we just constructed one day or something.
Well, it's intimately familiar suggests that when the fifth skandha, when consciousness is engaged,
mm-hmm.
then everything is familiar and engaged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm in a hospital bed and I'm essentially brain dead and they want to harvest my organs, they say, well, I still have my autonomic system working okay, and probably my limbic system is working okay too. It's just that I have no cerebral function,
mm-hmm.
you know, that operates. Mm-hmm. So this person has no sense of self, therefore yeah. let's take his liver.
Uh-huh.
That sort of thing.
All five skandhas are operating.
Well, I would think that the fifth, maybe the consciousness, the mind.
Maybe
is not
very, very subtle.
Very, very, very subtle. Very subtle. Mm-hmm. So, but if we get to this place where we, from the very moment our consciousness turns on, we are creating a familiarity, mm-hmm. a home, then I could say, yeah, that produces a sense of self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, consciousness in all five, and I think eventually I hope that we get into like really like looking at how these five skandhas work together, because it's just the Buddha's model of how, you know, what seems to be the person is like, or it's the building blocks for the sense of a self is the five skandhas in Buddha's model, which is, you know, longhand for body and mind experience. Any other people have checks out for this week?
It's amnesia.
Yeah.
I had experience. I was a motorcycle accident. And I woke up in the ambulance and had no idea why I was there, except that I was in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognized it as an ambulance because of the attendants and stuff like that. And I remember them saying, oh, he's awake now. So they handed me a piece of paper so that I could take a tow away my bike. And I signed my name. But there was nothing else there. It was just like blank.
And it wasn't even like remembering your name. Maybe your hand was just used to that signature, right?
It was just physical. Yeah. The, you know, sign papers.
I wonder if, you know, in this and also like Liz's example of like just waking up, it's like, yeah, in a way, you know, we don't remember our name maybe or who we are, our like identity, but even then, I wonder if there's still this sense of like, there's somebody here. Like it's not like we're just merged with the room, you know, or something like that. There's like, we open our eyes and like, there's a body mind experience even if we don't remember our name. I think that would, and if so, I would still say that would be the sense of the inherently existent self. It's not necessarily like a personal, unique identity. It's just the sense that there's like, just consciousness and conception basically create this sense that there's somebody here. I think it's just like so primitive.
So even to say, I don't know who I am.
Even then.
I don't know who I am.
Yeah. But there's still like,
I don't know who I am.
I am. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. Well, and if we, especially if the word I is in it, I don't know who I am. Well, who doesn't know? There's somebody here who's confused.
This was at the core of Eckhart Tolle's major experience. When he tells the story how he was so miserable. He says he caught himself saying, I can no longer live with myself.
Yeah.
And then he had this notion, are there two of me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The I that cannot live with myself.
Yeah.
You know.
So I think he probably realized something about which is even things like, you know, this is my arm, is a little bit like, I can't live with myself. He just, it was so clear in that moment, and then he was in such pain that he's like, wait a second. And I think, again, being in a lot of pain and then seeing how the mind is like, doesn't make sense. It's not, doesn't, our usual experience of the I that can't live with myself doesn't make any sense. And then it, the illusion dropped away of the duality. But even just, we might even be able to say like, oh yeah, this is my arm. And already right there be like, huh? Whose arm? If we really like get the impact of this is my arm, that might be enough to just like snap us out of like the strange idea that there's somebody whose arm this is. Yes, Rich.
I had an experience the week before last, before the first class, that reminded me some of what Johnny was talking about. It was a car ran into me on Main Street in Watsonville. There was a reaction that I could recall in memory of the experience. It was a car coming at me that I saw in my peripheral vision as I was going this way, and me trying to shift as far to the right as I could and accelerate, and it happened in milliseconds. And then the experience of having the back of the car pushed like this, and then the knowledge that it hit me anyway. So there was that. And of course, my heart rate was over 100, and the adrenaline was pumping and everything. But there was no time to think about what was going on. There was only time for the body to initiate that response. So then, my mind was completely filled after that, as I pulled over and stopped, and this driver pulled behind me and stopped, and the traffic had to work their way around us. Just these questions kept coming up. It's like, didn't she see me? Why did she hit me? Right. It just kept going around and around in circles. Anger and irritation about being inconvenienced for a period of time on my way back to the office.
It also occurred.
This is all going on, but somehow or other, like Johnny, it wouldn't have done any good to get mad, start yelling or anything. It was like, exchange insurance information. She didn't speak good English, so it would have been futile to vent anyway, I suppose. But anyway, and we had insurance information to exchange and pencil and paper, and we did all that. And when it was all over, I said thank you, and I guess we can go. And there was no point trying to call CHP. I mean, the damage wasn't that bad. Bumper damage. Anyway, but then for the next several days, I could say weeks, because I'm remembering it right now, this particular question, you know, it's something to chew on, you know. What was that? And what you said tonight is, here I was thinking that it was the thoughts that came up afterwards that was caused by the view of the inherent I.
I think, yeah, they
but
are.
The reaction to get out of the car's way before it hit me that caused the adrenaline, that was a survival response. And there's no way we can get rid of that or we'll just die. Survival.
What breaks them?
That's what I'm... Yeah. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
Breaks them a little bit, yeah.
But it's how we deal with that sense of I-ness, I think, it's
Well, maybe we can just leave it open, this you know, is this how this view operates at immediate, like, physical impact or something. But let's go as close as we can to that in terms of our response, and see the sense of the eye that comes up there. Because, yeah, it could be that actually there's just a physiological thing, but and that based on the physiological thing, that triggers the view. The view is like activated full speed.
Then the questions.
Yeah.
And
it struck me too when you were speaking that, I don't know if this was the actual experience, but when you said like, I can't believe she hit me, when actually... what I was going to say, she didn't hit you.
Oh, no.
She hit
a car
that your body and mine was in. But that's another thing, right? It's,
the car is part of me.
Yeah, exactly. We identify with, she hit me.
With our possession.
It's not even your body, but yeah, this gets into like...
So as opposed to just the causes and conditions that made the collision, there's this extra element that came in clearly later of taking it personally.
Yes.
So that person and personally is it. That's a sense that I have a... This domain has been insulted.
Exactly.
Taking it personally. That's personally. A nice phrase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Taking it personally. Yeah. At what point do we... But the most immediate moment when we start to take something personally, and it could be seem to be the same time as a kind of physiological response. Especially, I mean, it's one fight and flight thing, but to be insulted, for example, isn't... The false accusation thing is nice because it's not a survival mechanism there, right? But we have a physiological response that may be just as bad as being hit by a car.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody says, "How dare you have, like, not done such and such?" And just like, whoom, the chemicals start flowing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the defensive sense, I think defensiveness is nice because we're defending me. You know, it's like, I didn't do it.
No damage whatsoever, except to pride.
Yeah, yeah. Except to the self, right? The self. And in fact, the body, mind, skanda, organism thing doesn't need to be damaged, especially with a false accusation. If you can then explain, like, oh, actually, no, you misunderstood, you missed some information here, it was like this, and oh, I'm sorry. But before even explaining, we feel like not that our body or mind are going to be damaged, but our sense of self is being threatened.
And that seems to be precognitive. I'll be praying out of four, where four is like for me reputation. I've got reputation, credentials, which are all external. But this thing here that gives rise to what I think Rich was saying and I was saying, it's precognitive. I don't have to summon an idea of myself to be insulted.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in that sense, I'll say there's an innate default that says, I have been insulted. I'll say that.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go with that for now. Yes.
Just one thing to add. So years ago, I read a book by Jean Fulton Taylor. She's a neurophysiologist, and she had a stroke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, she was saying that as she lost a part of her brain hemisphere function, that she really lost that sense of self, and she was in really just physiological bliss. And so,
even while she was having a heart attack,
right,
a stroke.
Yeah, she was feeling great. And mm-hmm. so, to me, that says that, okay, maybe that part of our brain, that false sense of self, can be changed.
Mm-hmm.
It can
be
changed.
That's a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. And she was fully conscious, and she didn't have the slightest fear or worry, even if she was going to die.
Yeah.
I think she even had the thought, like, I'm having a stroke and I got to make this phone call. But like, it wasn't like a big problem. It's just like, I have to do this. Come on, like, try to do this. But like,
and how do I? She didn't know how to push the numbers.
Yeah, she couldn't figure it back and forth. And so I think in the end, the possibilities are like, there's no fear of death. I mean, the Buddha was the deathless, right? It was like, we're not, this body and mind, whatever happens is not going to be a problem. I think that's what's being offered as the culmination of this path. And, but, you know, all along the way, I think it can be this really gradual thing that just less and less self-identification is more and more free, you know. And then that gets into the subtlety. It's like, I don't have a problem with maybe a lot of the things I used to have a problem with, but I have a problem here. And like, so let's work on that one, and then we maybe see through that, and then I have a problem here. Our problems maybe get less and less, but until there's, not the slightest identification with it, or belief in holding the view of the independently existent self, then there's probably going to be some slightly deeper level to keep working with. which is great because Zen Center can keep going. if it was really easy to just kind of finish this off, we'd all go home and have to close it down.
I think that's what drugs are for.
Drugs, we can maybe get like a quick taste of some of this stuff, actually, but then it's like our karmic patterns are still totally in place, and we gotta like, you know, work it. So, back to this types of self list. So, you know, the dependently co-arisen one is just to say that there's this whole inconceivable body-mind thing happening. That's just the way the world seems to work. And then part of that, part of dependent co-arising, is this dependently arisen conceptual imputation. It's an aspect of the dependently co-arisen self. It's imagined to be inherently existent, but it's actually merely imputed independence on body and mind. It's also called the mere I. Okay, so not to be refuted, the inherently existent one we've been talking about. Deeply rooted illusion that conceptual imputation, that imputed self exists by way of its own character, from its own side. That self, which appears to be completely mixed together with the body and mind, is the most subtle self that must be refuted. Now this four, we haven't talked about yet, these other false views of self are these other illusions of inherently existent self that are not innate, learned from others or through false thinking and speculating, often from religious teachings, actually. Such as like an eternal soul, an Atman, this self which often appears to be something other than the five aggregates must also be refuted. So I think it's interesting here that this maybe doesn't always hold up, but in general it seems that the deepest, most subtle, innate view of the independent self seems to be completely mixed with body and mind. That's why it's so hard to locate it, because we keep, you know, it's, and it moves around in our experience. But like an eternal soul, it's just in Christian teachings, for example, seems to be like not a kind of in the body and mind, in the part of the five aggregates. I don't understand, I know the teachings so well, but I think it's maybe like it's the, I don't know, if it's a container for our body-mind experience. Or maybe it is in, but it's not exactly, it's definitely not the same as body and mind, right? The soul. And the Atman, I think, so in Vedanta, so we have some people who heard many of these Vedanta Hindu teachings, and did they ever have classes on how the Atman works in relation to the...
Sure they did.
Do you remember anything?
Well, it's like the ultimate...
The ultimate self.
Yeah.
And my... Well, my understanding, just like looking a little bit into the like Vedanta views of the Atman, are like it's not the ego self. It's not the it's sometimes translated as self. And by the way, the German word for self is Atem, which is, you know, our language. What do you call them?
Indo-European
language. In, you know,
Atem.
Yeah. Sanskrit and English have many similar roots, and I think that's one of them. Atam actually doesn't mean self, it means breath. And one, Atam means breath in German, but one explanation said that the word Atman originally referred to breath, which is like kind of like the life principle that keeps us alive. And my understanding is that, like in Vedanta teachings, these were like at the time of Buddha, that the Buddha was saying there's anatman, because the Atman is like the your kind of true self that then you unite with like the universal Brahman, and that's what liberation is. You unite your kind of personal true self with the universal true self. And even in Advaita Vedanta, or his non-dual Vedanta, there's still the Atman. There is some interesting things, like, because sometimes very, very similar to Buddhist teachings, And like we have Ramana Maharshi, right? People might know of him, who comes from this Vedanta background, but he, I think, had this awakening, not really based on these teachings, but just a personal, it just happened to him. It was like grace. And but then he's taught, because that was the tradition he was in, he taught through that language. But I thought this was similar, really listen to see how this sounds very similar to Buddha's teaching, but slightly different. This is Ramana Maharshi. He says, I am not the five sense organs and their objects. The breath, I'm not the breath, I'm not the thinking mind, I'm not even a subtle objectless mind. After negating all this as not this, not this, neti, which is similar to what we're doing here, I think, actually. It's like self-inquiry was Ramana Maharshi's thing. I'm not this, I'm not this. And after going through every possible thing that I might be, awareness alone remains. I am that. So, and there are Buddhist teachings that are quite similar to this, but in terms of our discussion now, these basic Buddhist teachings, we would say, if awareness is like, if we're saying that's the consciousness skanda, I am not that. The Buddha said, in that first teaching, or early teaching, the body is not me, the feelings are not me, conceptions are not me, habitual karmic formations are not me, consciousness, this very subtle awareness every moment of what's happening, that's not me. And maybe even in Vedanta, they would say, it's not that consciousness that I am that. And same within Buddhism, they say, later Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhism say, well, there is this, Buddha mind that's not consciousness, and like, I am that, Buddha nature. So, but in the early teachings, Buddha was really into like, we're not going to set up anything that the I is. It's about more like neti, like I'm not the five skandhas, and it's seeing that that's none of those are truly who I am. That's the freedom. Now this later tradition says, well, the Buddha didn't, mention so much that there's this conceptually imputed self, and it's good to remember that, otherwise it sounds too strange. Well then, but who is experiencing this?
It's just the conceptual. Means thusness gone.
Yeah, or thusness come, coming from thusness, going to thusness. Ramana Maharshi says, self is where there's no I thought. Self itself is I. Self is silence. Contemplate nothing but self until self is realized. And this is quite similar, and maybe the result is quite similar too. But, philosophically speaking, in a way they're like opposites. Instead of saying, like, come to see this Atman, that's not the ego self, but there is this true self, whereas Buddha's saying, don't look for anything there, it's just metaphysical ideas, just, you won't find anything at all. Which was really, like, as a religious belief, very unusual in Buddhism. Just like not positing anything that we can't actually experience.
He eliminated the back door.
Something like that.
He eliminated the back door. We can't just go into a realm of believing, oh, there'll be placeholders for all the stuff I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no, there's nothing to understand there. Nothing you can't understand. You got to be here and stay here, and this is it.
Mm-hmm. Body-mind experience of the moment. So these other false views of self, if we say that the inherently existent innate one is like mixed with body and mind, these other ones tend to be something other than the five aggregates. Like an Atman isn't in relation to the five aggregates, and a soul also. So these ones are not as, they're learned, they're not innate, but they also have to be refuted to be free from this view. There are other views of an inherently existent self, actually, you should say. And then I just added in this true self, sometimes in Zen we might use such words. It's not really in the tradition so much, a true self, But if we hear, if we say, well, what's the true self in Buddhism or Zen? Because sometimes they use that type of language. Or we could say it's the ultimate truth beyond existence and non-existence of a self. It's the emptiness or absence of any type of inherently existing self or no self. You know, any inherently existing non-self. It's free of anything like that. Manifested as joyful, compassionate, spontaneous freedom.
So this is the 92nd ancestor saying this.
Yes. So then we have meditation on self and not self. So this is just something we could, you know, how to put this into practice in Zazen. So to sit silently and brightly in the present, let go of past, future, and all discursive thinking while focusing on the clear, open, aware quality of mind until body and mind are quite calm and concentrated. So just Zazen practice. Just settle, relax into the present moment. You might think, well, isn't that good enough? Should we stop there? But now, for the sake of this class, and we can do this investigation while we're there. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a little disturbing to Zazen. So there's a little renunciation of the pleasant present of Zazen to do this, just for these few weeks, if you'd like. So feel a sense of I, and this is kind of what we've been talking about, but doing this in Zazen now. And the way it's put here, according to tradition now, that often is said like this, this is weird sounding, right? Carefully extract a small corner of this concentration and use it to identify a clear, vivid, strong sense of the person who's meditating. We're talking about now a sense of the inherently existent self. And extracting this means, like, if we do this too roughly, if we're like really subtle and like, okay, what's the sense of self? Like, bring on like some, you know, false accusation or something. We're just going to lose the settled, relaxed quality. So this is a kind of an interesting type of meditative practice to, like, another way it said is from a corner of your mind, start like kind of looking around in your body-mind experience for this sense of self. And you could do it, like I said, just there's somebody here meditating. Try to get a sense of that person meditating.
Or what about questions like, am I comfortable?
Yeah.
Is
body questions, for sure.
Is my knee pain
yes.
a little better,
yeah.
or is it a little worse?
Yeah, my knee pain.
Am I tired?
Mm-hmm.
Just those yeah. kinds of exploration.
Yeah. I think those are work.
Is the subject.
Yeah, exploring whatever the experience, actually we're always having an experience, and that's what Zazen is actually like just being present with our experience. So we take that experience and then look for this particular thing of like the person that it's happening to. Right? So like not the feeling of tiredness actually, but well, who is feeling tired? Tiredness might be a hard one because it's hard. This view, the thing about it, like I mentioned last time, but I think very interesting is that like it's very hard to do this step, to find this sense, because it's not a substantial solid thing that's residing in some particular location. It's a view that's not really going to hold up, but even when it seems to, it's moving around. And if we try to like, oh, okay, the person who thinks he's tired, but then actually that one slips away and then there's another sense of a self. And it seems like it's the same person, actually, but it moves around depending on the experience. But here's some other, you know, ways you can do it. It helps to silently say I, or one's own name. And little experiments I've done with this is I've noticed for myself, so I go by Kokyo, you know, and before that I was Luminous Owl. And before that I was Charlie. And when I say, if I'm silently say to myself, Charlie in Zazen, it has a very different feeling. Like more, I think because it was this childhood thing, right? Mm-hmm. More like identified self, even though I haven't used that name for years, mm-hmm. I feel more a sense of self with that name. Because I think it was formed around that name, right? Mm-hmm. It was one of the first things I learned, was to identify myself with that name. And it's connected with a name, right?
Yeah. Part of my experience in this exploration last week, both of positive and negative, praise, I had a day where I had
positive and negative.
There's like an age. I have a strong image when I see who's, you know, when I, of who's angry or who's puffed up. And I'm like, usually maybe 5 years old.
Interesting.
I can see my butt. It's like,
Yeah, we talk about, like, you know, our angry child and stuff like that, because in a way maybe we're reverting back to
like
a...
where we form, you know,
when the self was first, the independently existent self, even if it was innate, it's when it first started being, like, I think of it as a, it's like a computer program that's not yet, you know, installed. It's like on the computer, but like maybe around 5 or 6, I don't know what age, maybe Sally can, from her kids, can tell when sometime when they start saying me and mine. It's pretty early, actually, right?
Yeah, it's pretty early.
He still looks at pictures and he says I. I don't think he's referring to the I.
He's
used to language being I.
Oh, okay. Pictures of himself?
Pictures of himself. He goes daddy and I.
Yeah. So that's a double identification with, in that case, that's a, we could say the body. It's like the first skanda is pictured there, and we've seen it in the mirror enough that there's no other skandas, but like, that's me. That's another interesting one, pictures. And we can look at that, we can look at a 2-year-old picture of ourself too, and feel like that's the same me as now. It's amazing. How do we do that? And really feel that it's true, don't we? That's an example of particularly the permanence aspect of the self, like through time. Not only do we feel we're the same person, we're the same actual entity, person as yesterday, but the same one as that picture of the 2-year-old. I mean, maybe someone has to tell us, or I guess we've seen enough pictures gradually that we know that we remember that picture.
I think there's an age where I can definitely see myself. I think it is a little older. And I'm always surprised when I look at some pictures of myself as a toddler, and I actually have to work at it to see if that's myself or my sister. I don't have that identification in it, too. Is that me or Mary Lou? You know? But if it was me at 6 or 7, or maybe probably even 5, I would definitely get it. But a bunch of times I look at this one picture of us as little, and it's like, I really don't know what it is.
Yeah, and at some point, at some age, you can start to project your thoughts into the picture. Like, I just got some old pictures from my parents sent me, and there was a kind of teenage, high school maybe kind of picture, and I felt like, yeah, there's almost like different identification with different ages, but I felt like some emotional quality maybe even from like that connected with the me of that picture, but it definitely feels like no doubt that that's me. You know, and then the, you know, the accurate thing that we wouldn't need to refute is like, because it's not really this the me, the conventional me of right now, but we'd say, but there is a strong connection, and the connection is just dependence. It's just the me of today is dependent on that, on the teenage me, through a lot of links in between. So there's not like there's no connection, but there's no identity carrying through. It's just a dependently arisen, you know, series of me's, conventionally me's.
It's amazing that we don't think about, you know, how dependent we are on our parents, and yet. And all the other things that, you know, we're dependent on, we don't identify with them at all.
Even today I was thinking about eating food and air that actually, like, totally sustains. I mean, for, like, half a minute, if we lose air, I will die, right? And maybe a minute, a couple minutes or something, right? And yet it's totally, like, That's another meditation, is totally sustaining the conventional self. But that's it's related to when we're investigating the independent self, because we feel like that me, this would be another kind of test to see, are we finding the actual independently existing me, that which of course doesn't exist, right? The, in quotes, independently existing, the sense that there's really somebody here. We feel like that one doesn't depend on air. Like the me who's falsely accused is like, that's going to stand up no matter what. Even when we die, I think that's in a way why maybe we're not so afraid of death in the abstract sense if we're healthy, because actually, well, we feel like this I, the core I, will just, how could it ever end? Right? It's like, it just goes on and on, it never changes. Maybe as we get close to death, it maybe gets easier to do some of these meditations. Like, well, what's going to happen to the me? But even then, all the religions give some comfort in, well, I will go on, but I would be up there, down there, or be reborn. But Buddhism actually doesn't say the I will be reborn. That's what's interesting. It says this, but it does say, that's related, just as a little footnote here, that conventionally, the number two, the conceptually imputed self, according to Buddhism, that's what's reborn. According to Madhyamaka school. Different schools of Buddhism have, the Yogacara mind-only school says Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness, is what's reborn. It's also not a self. It's not a substantial thing. It's a dependently arisen, swirling mass of unknown. But that relationship, in a way, to the world is reborn. Not exactly reborn as a thing, but like continues. Where there's a continuum of moments. But interestingly, the Madhyamaka tradition says, of course, there's no independent I to be reborn, which the Vedanta thing would say that's what is actually the Atman is reborn. But if there's no Atman, what's reborn? Actually, this view. That's why it's innate, too, we could say. The view that there's, depends on body and mind, of the core fundamental ignorance arises dependent on a previous moment of fundamental ignorance connected with a body and mind. So one body and mind with all its karmic tendencies and ignorance ceases, and then boom, you have another body and mind, embryo, and fundamental ignorance of inherent existence is like right there. This is a story, but the tradition story. It works well, though. It all kind of fits together.
The last class series we talked about.
Two words I associate with four is reputation and respect. Operationally. And it's interesting what those two
I think
words.
Those are connected with it. They're not actually it.
No, I didn't say that.
Yeah, okay. But connected with it. Yeah.
Operationally. Mm-hmm. In other words, was before insult was, with three, mm-hmm. the sense of this myself is actually being challenged. There's this other area where I'm not being respected, mm-hmm. or my reputation is at risk. Reputation, like take the M off of repute, mm-hmm. and you got mm-hmm. re, and then respect, and to look it back or look a second time, mm-hmm. there is a sense that there is something that's being looked at or imputed a second time.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so but that is all dependent upon kind of my personal history that I'm aware of. It's external to myself. And that's why I read this rather than Atman, this kind of a soul thing, is that I can get exercised over my reputation
totally
not being seen, and not being respected.
But isn't reputation based on a sense of identity?
Yeah. I don't think I have to go so far as to say I'm talking about a soul.
Oh yeah. Good point. I think soul is a kind of religious idea.
Yeah.
Based on this like basic aspect of mind where people. I think the Buddha was like really a pragmatist and really like, let's just go to our experience and like not come up with any like weird ideas about here. Let's just see what seems to be the case. Very much like maybe modern psychology or something, but looking very deeply. So we feel this sense of I in this meditation. I put it, so, you know, to say one's name or to imagine being falsely, you could use insulted, frightened is a good one, or praised, or, you know, good or bad. Sometimes the thought, I'll never be able to realize awakening, can help bring it up. Or in a class like this, it might be like the thought, like, I'll never understand this, or like, I don't get it, and, you know, it's a great opportunity if you feel like that in the class. There it is. Right? Who's that, like, one who's like, I must be really dumb or something, I don't get it. Like, we're just like creating, it's not really the case, right? We feel like there's somebody who's not getting it. Or in Zazen, if we get frustrated, this one who's like, can't ever concentrate. Like, find that, you can use those unconcentrated periods as an opportunity to like, oh yeah, there's the self, the one that feels like, I'm no good, this Zazen stuff. Or the other way around, like, I am so concentrated, like, this is like, you know, nobody else is ever as concentrated as me. It is too. So then, as it says here, stay focused on this sense or feeling of I and examine whether it seems to exist inherently by way of its own character. It does seem to. That's just a hint that how this works, you know. Maybe we shouldn't say, just see for yourself if it does. So I think we can continue this week, maybe with this, you know, further details of this discussion, trying to locate the you know, we have all the symptoms, but like, go to like, what's the source of the symptoms in terms of a me? Like, we feel the sense of me, and just to look without analyzing. Right, without actually analyzing, just see if it, in our experience, seems to exist of its own accord. And I think the nice thing about this is this word inherent existence that we throw around, or independent existence, is so abstract philosophically, but this is about really like getting a sense of like what we're talking about when we say inherent existence, that we're going to actually end up refuting. Because if we just refute something abstract, there's no real point. So we get this sense of like, oh yeah, the way that it appears to exist, that's often how they say it too, is the I, the way it appears to exist, is the inherently existent I. And we might say, it doesn't appear that way, but like, see if we can see how there's a way in which it appears to us to exist, you know, of its own accord, in an almost like indestructible way. That would be another way to say it. Like, even, you know, my body can get hurt, but, like, I will continue. My mind can even disintegrate, but I continue. And if you feel like you're already doing that and you want to go on to the next step, you can read that there about, before, it's again, before investigating, this is like just coming to this conclusion that two things either have to be the same or different. So this is getting into like kind of philosophy here. And that's a really weird one that a lot of people have a hard time doing, this, getting this basic point, is that if you have two different things, the relationship, two actually existent things, the relationship has to be one of two kinds. Either they're identical or they're different. And like, so you can just kind of start to think about that point. We'll talk about more next time. In other words, there's no way that they're kind of the same and kind of different. We have to like really be clear that there's no such thing as like blurry kind of mixed relationship here. And that kind of basic thing about things are either the same or different. And like actually thinking about that enough to like be totally convinced that two things must be either the same or different is that kind of thing of like that very sharp, clear logic is the basis for what Nagarjuna does his work with. Like you have to like, you can't kind of be murky around this kind of thing.
Yeah, so that's an interesting example
that And actually they get it. That's what we're going to look at too, is relationships like that that don't seem to be the same or different, but actually in terms of entity, a region of the universe and the universe itself, it's kind of like an overlap in that case. But a lot of the examples that Nagarjuna uses, because this is, we're going to start looking at the relationship now between the independent self and the five skandhas of body and mind. And there's a lot of relationships where it seems like, well, the five skandhas are kind of in the self, or the self's in the five skandhas. And those all come down to the same either or. So let me think of, that's a good example.
I have another example.
Yeah.
She's got one.
Say, like me working on a sculpture, it's not really separate from me. It's my mind
the sculpture?
Created it. Yeah.
It sort of is. Well, actually, in this case, what we're talking about, though, in fact, that's true. Relationally, interdependent things, dependently co-arising things, actually aren't in the either-or thing. They're dependent on each other. But inherently existent things, like actual entities that exist, if there were such a thing, maybe this is a good clarification. If there were an independently existing thing compared to another independent thing, they would have to be the same or different. So like these two things are either the same or different. They're in this case they're different, right? But like an example of same would be like, even if like there were a bunch of trees that actually, say, just imagine they actually inherently exist, trees, really existent trees, and a forest that makes up the trees. And that's an example of they're actually identical in entity. They're kind of like two different names for the same thing. But they're not like, well, the forest would, include some of these trees and some of these. It's just like, the forest and this group of trees are actually identical in entity. But most things that we compare are like different in entity. And we're talking about inherently existent, things existing in and of themselves. I think that's an important thing. So if we think that a sculpture really exists in and of itself and you exist in and of yourself, you are totally separate from the sculpture. In fact, it's not the case. You know it's not true, but actually, sometimes you might feel like when you first walk into the room, I don't know how it is with you. That would be an interesting thing to look at. Like, you might sometimes, if you think the sculpture's not going well according to like how you want it to go, you might feel like that's not me, and like I actually hate that sculpture. It has nothing to do with me, and like I'm gonna throw it out the window. Like, even though you're relating to it at that very time. But actually, the immediate impulse might be like, that is so separate from me. I think relationships, human intimate relationships, are great this way. And like, I am like so unseparate from this person. I feel like there's no separation at all. And like the next moment, it's like, I could kill that person. And they're like so separate, right? So like, because we often, at the root thing, we feel like we exist independently. We're not co-creating each other. We know we are. I mean, we know we are as good Buddhists. But actually, we feel, and this is what we're looking for now, is this first impulse of, like, separate. Mm-hmm. And me here, separate.
I just have a resistance to an either or.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, I think because you have some sense of, like, things are more, like, interdependent. And actually, interdependent things don't have to be either or. But that's what we're going to like have this premise that if things existed independently, they're either or. And I think we actually can find that, even though we resist it as an idea. I think our experience is like, right now, I have the sense of like me and that watch. I can think about how we're interdependent and come to that conclusion, but my first impulse is like, oh, there's me here and the watch there. We're like not the same entity. We're definitely not the same entity. That's my like first impulse. So this is, Buddhists have great, what to great realization of delusion is called Buddha. Mm-hmm. So we're really studying delusion here, mm-hmm. at least in these first few classes. We really get into like our core ignorance.
If we have a minute,
it's really kind of past time. Yeah.
I kind of wrestled with that a little bit and came to the same conclusions that you were talking about, but it became really simple for me because if it's inherently existing, it's not dependently co-arising.
Exactly.
And so as soon as we negate all these, we discover that the self is dependently co-arising.
And that's Nagarjuna's whole project, yeah.
Yeah, and so if we can get there and go through all these with that, and determine that we're constantly arising codependently with, or co-arising dependently with body and sense organs, with pain and pleasure, with sound and sense, with everything, then there is no inherent self.
Yeah, and he goes about this in different ways, but dependent co-arising is basically the proof that inherent existence is just an illusion. And that's another way of saying that is emptiness. Dependent co-arising is the proof for emptiness of inherent existence. And but he's going to do that in this particular way around the self and the skandhas. So thanks for bearing with this difficult material, and let's keep studying the self. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.